Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Good evening, everybody. Okay, so today we will be studying sutta number 35 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Chula Satchika Sutta, the shorter discourse to Satchika. And this is a particularly interesting sutta, first because it gives us some insight into the kinds of situations of social or cultural situations which prevailed among the ascetic communities during the time of the Buddha, the way they would challenge one another to debates and then sometimes engage in very strongly strong debates. And also, though the sutta has elements of drama and humor, it also takes us at the core to a very profound teaching. I think one of the clearest and most incisive teachings on the nature of the anatta doctrine, the doctrine of non-self. Okay, this sutta centers around a contemporary of the Buddha whose name was Satchika. And Satchika was, we would call him a sophist or a polemicist. He lived something like an ascetic way of life. And he would roam around from place to place, trying to find out who were the famous religious teachers and philosophers of the period. And he would engage them in debates and try to defeat them using all of his skills as a skills of logic and reasoning, skill in drawing up illustrations, analogies, as a way of overturning the position of his adversaries. And he is described in the text as Nigantaputta, which means a son of the Nigantas. The Nigantas, this was a term for the Jains. This was the term that the Jains used to describe themselves. And so Satchika is said to be a son of the Jains, which indicates that his parents were followers of the Jain teacher, Mahavira. Or at least it suggests that. According to the commentary gives some background explanation. And whenever I bring in the commentary, I always have to attach a little warning label to it that the commentaries date from 900 years after the time of the Buddha, and they develop gradually, accumulating legends, myths, methods of explanation that had gradually been accumulating over the centuries. And so we don't always have to accept what is said in the commentary. But still, sometimes the commentaries provide useful background information. And so the commentary says that Satchika's parents were both wandering debaters. They would travel the countryside of northern India, just like their son would do, finding the different philosophers, learning their teachings, then using their teachings to seek out weak spots, vulnerabilities, and then they would debate with the other teachers and overthrow them. In time, his parents had 5 children. 4 of them were girls. 1 was the boy, the youngest was Sachika. The four girls would, like their parents, they learned all of the points of philosophy, the art of debating, the rhetorical skills from their parents. And they, too, would travel around over the countryside as a group, debating with the different teachers. And in the course of their wandering, they came to Savatthi. Savatthi was the city where the Buddha would usually live. And when they came to Savatthi, then they set up a kind of challenge to the resident ascetics living in Savatthi to engage with them in debate. And when Sariputta, the Buddha's chief disciple, was going out from the monastery in alms round, he heard about this challenge, and so he invited these four sisters to come meet with him and debate with him. And first, he invited the four sisters to present their challenges to him, to ask him the questions. And all of the questions, all of the points of dispute that they brought up with him, he was able to reply to. Then they asked Venerable Sariputta to present his point of view. He presented his point of view, and the four sisters were left speechless. They couldn't reply to it. Now, there was a tradition in the time of the Buddha and continuing for centuries in Indian spirituality that when there is a debate, you see, in Indian religion, very different from Western religion. In Western religion, two people hold different points of view, then you get religious wars. Truly, Protestants and Catholicism, were there wars between the Roman Catholic Church, the Eastern Orthodox Church? I don't think so. But you have the wars of Catholics against Protestants going on from with the 15th century, 16th century, right up to Northern Ireland very recently. Then Christianity against Islam, Judaism against, well, Jews didn't fight with Christianity, but the Jews would fight with followers of the other religions in occupying Palestine in ancient times. Okay, so in the Western or Semitic religions, the principle is one fights the enemy. If one triumphs, one kills the enemy or converts them forcefully, sometimes with torture. In Indian spirituality, the principle is one has debates between the proponents of the different religions. And when one party defeats the other in debate, what happens? Sometimes the defeated party would just go off shamefully, feeling the stings, the pain of the debate. But the usual rule of etiquette is that when one is defeated in debate, then one gives up one's own creed and embraces the creed of the triumphant party. Okay, so these four sisters, they were defeated by Venerable Sariputta. And so what do? But they ask Venerable Sariputta to admit them to the Buddhist order. And so Venerable Sariputta sent them to the nuns' monastery at Savatthi, and the four became ordained as bhikkhunis, Buddhist nuns. And according to the commentary, before long, they practiced very diligently, and then they achieved arahatship. And so in their defeat, eventually they became triumphant by reaching the highest goal. Okay, but their brother, Sachika, heard this news, and he was very upset by it, and he thought that he would get his revenge by meeting the Buddhist monks, arguing with them, defeating them, and then even going up to the highest level, to the Buddha himself, and defeating the Buddha. Okay, so this sutta opens at a time when the Buddha was living in the city or near the city of Vaisali. Vaisali was a great city. I think it was just a little bit south of the river Ganges. And it was not a not a monarchy, but it was a republican state. And the people who were the dominant community in Vaisali were called the Lichavis. Okay, so now when the sutta opens, Satchika is living at Vaisali, and he's described as a debater, a clever speaker, and strangely it said, regarded by many as sadhu. The word sadhu sometimes means good, a good person, a holy person, but it comes to be used in India to mean something like a saintly person. It's a little bit strange why he should be regarded as saintly, simply because he's a good debater and a clever speaker. Especially when the next statement is going to show how he's rather boastful. Okay, so when the assembly of the people of Vaisali would meet, Satchika would go in front of them and he would say, I see no recluse or Brahmin, even one who is the head of a community, even one claiming to be an arahant, the holy one, someone perfectly enlightened, who would not shake, shiver, tremble, and sweat under the armpits if he were to engage in debate with me. And then in order to reinforce this point, he says that even if I were to engage in debate with a post of wood, a wooden post without any consciousness, it would shake, shiver, and tremble. So what is going to happen to a human being who engages in debate with me? Okay, then one morning, a monk, a disciple of the Buddha named Usaji, takes his bowl and robes and goes out of the monastery or out of the forest into the city of Vaisali to collect his alms. Then Satchika sees the Venerable Usaji walking in the distance. Then he approaches him. They exchange greetings. And then Satchika, he's going to try to provoke Usaji to engage him in the debate. And so he throws out a question. Maybe he's pretending to be just a curious inquirer. So he says, Venerable Usaji, how does the ascetic Gotama discipline or train his disciples? And how does the ascetic Gotama usually present his instructions to his disciples? Okay, then Usaji replies to Satchika. He says, this is how the Blessed One, the Buddha, usually presents his instructions to his disciples. This is how he trains his disciples. He says, monks, material form is impermanent, feeling is impermanent, perception is impermanent, the mental formations are impermanent, and consciousness is impermanent. Material form is not self, feeling is not self, perception is not self, the mental formations are not self, consciousness is not self. All formations are impermanent. All things are not self. Okay, first, we can ask, who is this monk Asaji besides being a disciple of the Buddha? He's not an ordinary disciple of the Buddha, but when the Buddha, before his enlightenment, undertook the practice of extreme austerities, there were five other ascetics who used to attend upon the Buddha and look after him. Or we say, who used to look after the Bodhisattva, the future Buddha, and look after him, thinking, surely this being, this person, is going to achieve enlightenment, and we should stay around him and take care of him, and when he reaches enlightenment, then he will instruct us. Okay, then when the Bodhisattva rejected the practice of austerities, he started to take normal food in order to regain his strength. And then those five ascetics became disillusioned and even disgusted with the Bodhisattva, thinking that he had given up his spiritual practice and returned to a life of self-indulgence. And so they abandoned him and went away. After his enlightenment, the Buddha was asking himself, to whom should I teach the Dhamma first? And after reflecting, he decided to seek out the five ascetics and teach them the Dhamma. And this became the content of the Buddha's first discourse, the Sutta on setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma. Okay. Of those five ascetics to whom the Buddha taught, the youngest was the monk named Asaji. And so the Buddha taught first the discourse on the Four Noble Truths. Shortly after, he taught the discourse on non-self. And when the Buddha taught the discourse on non-self, then the five newly ordained monks became arahants. So Asaji was one of the first five disciples of the Buddha. And not only was Asaji one of the first five disciples of the Buddha, but also, he was the monk who was instrumental in leading Sariputta and Moggallana to the Buddha. How is that so? Several months after the Buddha's enlightenment, this would have been after the first rainy season, the Buddha sent his disciples out in different directions. Okay, and so Asaji was traveling in one area, and then there was an ascetic, actually two ascetics, wandering ascetics, who had searched everywhere in northern India to find a teacher who could guide them to enlightenment. These two ascetics were named Sariputta and Moggallana. And so one day, Sariputta and Moggallana, they had gone on their alms round to the village, going in separate directions to different villages. And when Sariputta was walking around, suddenly he saw one ascetic, one Buddhist monk, walking very peacefully, very mindfully, going from house to house, collecting his alms food, then walking mindfully, gently, quietly to the next house. And when Sariputta saw this ascetic, he was struck with wonder and amazement. He was so impressed by the quiet, peaceful manner of that monk. And he thought, if there is anyone in this world who's enlightened or on the way to enlightenment, it must be that monk. But then he thought, this is not the time for me to question that monk. He's going on his alms round. Let me just wait patiently till he finishes his alms round and finishes his meal. Okay, so when that wandering monk had collected his food, Sariputta prepared a seat for him, offered him some water, and waited by the side. Then when he had finished his meal, then Sariputta approached him and asked him, who is your teacher? What does he teach? And that monk, that was Venerable Usaji. And Venerable Usaji, though he was an arhant, was very modest, very humble. He didn't like to engage in a lot of discussions, explanations, debates. And he was afraid that this ascetic who's come to me, asking me about the teaching I follow, he just wants to get into a debate with me. And so let me just reply to him that I haven't gone forth for a long time. I'm just newly ordained. Since actually he's just been ordained a few months, even though he's a fully enlightened arhat, but he says, I've just been ordained a few months, and I'm not really skillful in speaking, so I can't really explain the Dhamma to you at length. But Sariputta said, you don't have to explain to me in detail. Just teach me the essence. Even a little bit will be enough. Then Usaji just recited a four-line stanza. He said, whatever phenomena there are that arise from a cause, the Buddha has explained the cause, and also he has explained that which is their cessation, the cessation of all arisen phenomena. That is the teaching of the great sage. And when Sariputta heard that verse, immediately his wisdom eye opened and he saw the deathless Nibbana. And he reached the first stage of enlightenment, the stage of stream entry. And then he said to Usaji, he said, where is our teacher living now? Because he knew that Usaji's teacher was now his teacher. And so Usaji directed him to the bamboo grove at Rajagaha. First Sariputta went to Moggallana and told him what had happened. Then the two of them went to the bamboo grove. And as they were coming, the Buddha saw them approaching. And he told the monks, these two who are coming, these are going to be my chief disciples. Okay, so Usaji was, we could say, the one who connected Sariputta and Moggallana, the Buddha's chief disciples, who connected them to the Buddha, who directed them to the Buddha. But from this incident, we can see that Usaji, though very wise, his mind perfectly illuminated with the wisdom of the Dhamma, was not a gifted speaker. In fact, I don't think we have any discourses coming down from him except for that four-line stanza. And so probably here, he doesn't want to explain very much, and so he keeps his statement very brief. And if we look at the statement, something seems to be missing. What is missing? What's missing? No, consciousness is mentioned. Marcy. Okay, that's honorable that you. Huh? Who hasn't looked at the footnotes and wants to venture a guess? It shouldn't even be a guess. You should know immediately what's missing. Eva, you should know. What? Speak more loudly. No, no. But I know why you said Nibbana. Suki should know. Really? Wei Chung. You looked at the footnotes. George, you should know. Don't know. Something seems to be missing here. I can't hear. It should be just one word that I... Francis. No? Nobody could come up with. Okay, if nobody's going to come, nobody wants to venture a guess.
It's missing from the last line, right?
It's missing from this passage. Material form is impermanent, feeling is impermanent, and so on. Material form is not self, feeling is not self. All formations are impermanent, all things are not self. I heard it. Was that Venerable Guoqing? Right, dukkha or suffering. Usually we get all formations are impermanent, all material form is impermanent and so on. Material form and so on. Is dukkha, suffering, bound up with suffering, then material form and so on, are not self. Then from the Dhammapada we have sabbe sankhara anicchati, all conditioned formations are impermanent, sabbe sankhara dukkati, all conditioned formations are suffering, sabbe dhamma, anattati, all things or all phenomena are non-self. Okay, so in explaining the Buddha's teaching, Venerable Usaji has mentioned the five aggregates. He's mentioned that the five aggregates are all impermanent. He's mentioned that the five aggregates are all non-self. But he didn't mention that the five aggregates are suffering. Why is this the case? I'm not asking. I'm not asking you because I don't know myself. It's just conjecture. Why suffering is missing? The commentary gives an explanation, but it seems like the commentary is guessing. What the commentary says is that the world transcending paths and fruits, those are the four paths, and then the fruits, those are, you could say, the goal or the reason for living the spiritual life, and those are impermanent. And so there's a principle, whatever is impermanent is dukkha, suffering. So Asaji would have known that if he had mentioned the characteristic of suffering, that whatever is impermanent is suffering, that Satchika would have said, well, the paths and fruits, that for which you're practicing the Buddha's teaching, those are also impermanent. If they're impermanent, then they're also suffering. And so you're leading the spiritual life in order to attain suffering. But I have to say, this explanation in the commentary is not very convincing. But it's possible that Asaji was afraid that if he mentioned suffering, that Satchika would have used that in order to engage him in a debate. And he was a type who liked to keep quite aloof from these arguments, and so he didn't mention the characteristic of suffering. In any case, at this point, Satchika says he's going to sort of make a denigrating, insulting remark about the Buddha's teaching. He says, if what I've heard is really what the Buddha teaches, then what I have heard is something disagreeable. And then he expresses the wish, maybe at some time or another, I'll have the chance to meet your teacher, Venerable Gotama, and have a little discussion with him. And then I'll be able to detach him from that evil view. It's really hurling. It's like a dart, trying to strike the disciple right in the heart with a dart by insulting the Buddha's teaching, calling this an evil view. Okay, it seems that shortly after this encounter took place, Satchika made the decision not just to wait for a meeting with the Buddha to take place by chance, but he made the decision to go to the Buddha, face him directly, and engage him in a debate. And so Satchika was a very proud person, even a vain person. So he doesn't want to simply defeat the Buddha surrounded by the Buddha's monks, the Buddha's disciples, but he wants to be surrounded by a great number of citizens of this area. And so when the Lichavis are holding their assembly, he goes to the assembly and he says to them, come along, Lichavis, come along. Today I'm going to go out there to the great wood. I'm going to meet the ascetic Gotama, and I'm going to start a discussion with him, asking him about his teaching. And if he tells me the same thing that was told to me by this Venerable Asaji, then I'm going to reduce him to shreds. Then he uses some similes. Again, they're rather bold similes, dramatic similes, in order to show how he's going to defeat and demoralize the Buddha. He says it's just as if a man, a strong man, were to grab a ram by the hair and drag him around. So I'm going to drag the ascetic Gotama around in debate. And so on. He uses about four similes. And then he bids the Lichavis to come along. Okay, as they're going along, the Lichavis are discussing the outcome with one another. And we could see that the Lichavis divide into two groups. There are some who, even though the Buddha has come to Vaisali quite often. It's one of his main stopping points in his travels, even though the Lichavis many times have heard the Buddha give discourses, but not all of them have been convinced by the Buddha's teaching. And so there's a divided opinion. Maybe it's a little bit like opinion, who's going to win in the presidential debates coming up. So some say, who is this ascetic Gotama that he can defeat this great debater, Satchika, such a brilliant mind, the Satchika, so gifted in speech, so subtle in his argumentation. Of course, Satchika is going to just reduce the Buddha to shreds, to ashes. This Gotama, he doesn't stand a chance against Satchika. And then there were other Lichavis who must have been impressed by the Buddha's wisdom. And so they thought, how can Satchika refute our teacher, the Blessed One, the Buddha? Surely the Blessed One is going to defeat Satchika in debate. Okay, so Satchika, together with his crowd, arrive at the great wood. They arrive at the hall where the Buddha is staying, and then eventually they come to the presence of the Buddha. Then after Satchika exchanges pleasantries with the Buddha and so on, the Lichavis all come and they greet the Buddha. Then now we're in paragraph 9, and Satchika, again, in a subtle and polite way, he asked the Buddha for the opportunity to have a discussion with him. And we could see he's putting on a front, pretending that he's very humble, polite, and saying, I would like to question you, Venerable Gotama, about a particular point, if you would be so kind as to do me the favor of answering my question. And so the Buddha says, ask what you want. He uses the name Agivesana, that probably refers to the clan name of Satchika. Then Satchika, he wants to get confirmation that the Buddha teaches his disciples the same way that Asaji did. And so he says, how does Master Gotama train his disciples, and how does he present his instruction to his disciples? And then the Buddha answers in exactly the same way that Asaji did. And I find it, by the way, somewhat interesting that, this is a point that just occurred to me, even though again and again in the suttas we find impermanence, suffering, non-self, impermanent suffering, non-self, but there are two passages where we get this formula about sabbe sankhara, all formations, and then sabbe dhamma, all things. One is this sutta, and another is in the Samyutta Nikaya, chapter 22, I think it's sutta number 88 or 90. It's a sutta spoken to a monk named Channa. And in both of these suttas, where the Buddha speaks about all formations and all dhammas, both suttas mention only impermanence and non-self and don't mention the characteristic of suffering. And maybe it's for that reason, in the Chinese way of understanding the three Dharma seals, the three distinctive marks of the Dhamma, it comes out all formations are impermanent, all Dhammas are non-self, and then Nirvana, Nibbana, is peaceful or quiescent, but no mention is made of dukkha or suffering. But the way the the Dharma sales are transmitted in Tibetan Buddhism. This would come from late North Indian Buddhism. They have four Dharma seals. One is that all formations, all conditioned things are impermanent, all contaminated or tainted, defiled formations are bound up with suffering, all phenomena are non-self, and nirvana is peaceful. Okay, anyway, here the Buddha speaks only about the five aggregates being impermanent and being non-self. And now Satchika is going to launch his attack, or at least he thinks he's going to do so. And so he's going to do so by using one of the standard tools in the Indian system of debating. As Indian logic developed, it laid out certain principles or laws that should be followed in constructing an argument. The actual formal rules of debate, of argumentation, took place centuries after the Buddha. But when Indian logic was formulated, Buddhist logic, the basic principle was to use the major premise, like, for example, all human beings are mortal. The minor premise, Socrates is a human being. Then a conclusion, therefore Socrates is mortal. But then there's a fourth component in the argument. The fourth component is a simile. In order to reinforce one's point, to make it especially convincing, to make it seem cogent, one devises a simile which conforms to the basic logic of the argument. And so now, at this point in Indian history, the rules of logic have not yet been formulated, and so Satchika doesn't follow the standard step-by-step procedure, but he begins with a simile, trying to lay out a simile which will provide a basis for his argument. And so he starts by mentioning that all of the seeds and plants that grow, develop, and reach maturity, all do so in dependence on the earth, based on the earth. And whatever deeds are done, whatever kind of work is done, farming, trade, carpentry, elephant taming, all the different types of work, all of this activity takes place in dependence upon the earth, based upon the earth. Okay, that is the simile. And then, to fill out the analogy, Satchika says, so too, a person has material form as his self. And based upon material form, he produces merit or demerit. He does good deeds or bad deeds. A person has feeling as his self. Based upon feeling, he does good and bad deeds. The person has perception as self, the mental formations as self, consciousness as self, and based upon consciousness, he does good and bad deeds. Okay, so this shows how the analogy or simile can be worked out, the plants that grow and the human activities that take place, these are like the good and bad deeds, and the earth that supports all the plants and human activities, these are like the five aggregates, but not as bare aggregates, not as mere aggregates, not as empty aggregates, but aggregates conceived to be a self, taken to be a self. Okay, but the way Satchika has formulated this, he doesn't quite state explicitly, I take the five aggregates to be self. It's a little bit disguised, a little bit concealed, his position. He says, a person has material form as self. And based upon material form, he does good and bad deeds. So there's another factor here. Okay, so the way Satchika formulates it, the person is something distinct from the five aggregates that has these five aggregates, and the five aggregates constitute the self of the person. But Satchika is not explicitly, at this point, stating that he takes the five aggregates as self. And so the Buddha draws out this conclusion for him. The Buddha asks, are you not saying that material form is myself, feeling is myself, perception is myself, formations are myself, consciousness is myself? And then Satchika replies, now Satchika will admit this openly. He says, I'm asserting this, Master Gotama. Material form, that's the body, is myself, feeling is myself, perception is myself, formations are myself, consciousness is myself. And so now, with this, we can see why Satchika, when he heard the explanation of the Buddha's teaching from the Venerable Lusaji, why he became so displeased and said, what you're telling me is something disagreeable, and I'm going to have to detach your master, the Buddha, from that evil view. Because Satchika is completely convinced about the reality of a self. He takes the five aggregates to be his self. Okay, so now Satchika admits, he says, I'm saying this, the form is myself, feeling, perception, the mental formations, consciousness is myself. But now this great self-confident, proud debater is not content just to assert his own position, but he turns to the crowd and says, I say this, and so does this great multitude. You know, he thinks that philosophical truth is to be decided by majority vote. And so the Buddha then calls him up on this very cleverly. The Buddha says, What does this multitude have to do with you, Satchika? Just you stick to your own position here. What do you say? Okay, so at this, then Satchika reaffirms his position. Yes, the five aggregates are myself. Okay, now the Buddha is going to attack him to tear down his position, but not to do it directly. Instead, again, the Buddha is going to use an analogy to bring down Satchika's position, affirming the reality of the self. And the Buddha's argument here has special importance because it's not only relating to Satchika's conception of a self, but it's honing in on the fundamental preconception that underlies all clinging to the idea of a self, all positions that affirm a real substantial self. Okay, so the Buddha now uses, he's approaching the issue indirectly with an analogy. He says, what do you think, Satchika? Suppose we have a powerful king like King Pasenadi of Kosala or King Ajatasattu of Magadha. Such a king, doesn't such a king exercise power in his own realm so that he can execute anyone he wants to execute, fine those who he wants to fine, and banish those who should be banished? Then Satchika admits this. Yes, a powerful king could exercise such power in his own realm. And even those like the Vajjayans, those are the people of the state of the Vajji Republic, and the Malans, those are people living in the northeast of India. These are the aristocrats and the republics. They exercise such power in their own realm. So what to speak about a powerful king like King Pasenadi or King Ajatasattu? Certainly they could exercise such power in their own realm. Okay, now paragraph 13, the Buddha asks, what do you think, Agivesana? When you say material form is myself, do you exercise any such power over this material form such that you can say, let my form be thus, let my form not be thus. And when the Buddha asked that question, Satchika had very sharp intelligence. He was not the dummy. And so when the Buddha asked that question, immediately Satchika could understand the implications, and he knew, I'm lost, I'm defeated. And so he didn't want to admit defeat, and so he just kept silent. Okay, a second time the Buddha asks, a second time Satchika is silent. Okay, then the Buddha says to him, this isn't the time to be silent. If anyone, when asked a reasonable question three times by the Tathagata, by the enlightened one, does not answer, his head splits into seven pieces there and then. Okay, maybe when you read this, you think, well, who says that the Buddha has compassion for everybody. How come the Buddha teaches others abstain from the taking of life, give up taking life, but the Buddha is going to split this guy's head into 7 pieces? But maybe 2 things that could be said about this. First, just taking it on its own terms, the idea here is not that the Buddha through his own wills, through his own mind, wills this to take place, but rather this is supposed to be like a fixed law that because the Buddha has so much spiritual might, spiritual majesty as being the supreme teacher, if somebody comes to him to engage him in debate and they're having a discussion, and then the Buddha asks them a quite legitimate question when the Buddha traps them and asks them a question 3 times, if he doesn't answer, then he's like going against the spiritual center of gravity that the Buddha represents. It's somewhat like if somebody goes to the top of a precipice, and just keeps on walking and walking and walking, and then falls off and falls down the precipice to his death. We can't blame the precipice for his death, but it's that person's fault for foolishly walking over the precipice. Okay, so this is just the nature of things that this will happen. So that's the first thing I had to say. The second thing is, it's never actually happened. I think when a debate takes place, when the Buddha sees that the person is holding back, then the Buddha gives him this warning and the person will answer. It might also just be a kind of dramatic device with which the compilers of the suttas sought to reinforce the spiritual glory of the Buddha. Okay, anyway, at this point, a certain spirit is actually described as a thunderbolt-wielding spirit. His name is Vajrapani. Vajra is the thunderbolt, Pani is hand. And so he's called a thunderbolt-wielding spirit. But it could also be understood it might be understood as the spirit named Vajrapani, but it shouldn't be understood in that way. But this word Vajrapani later became the proper name of a spirit that was considered a kind of guardian spirit of Buddhism. Okay, so on this occasion, just above Satchika in the air, this terrifying spirit appears with a monstrous face, with flames coming out from his body, and he's holding a thunderbolt in his hand, an iron thunderbolt that's burning, blazing, and glowing, and looking down at Satchika, sort of giving him a warning. This is why nobody refuses to answer the Buddha 3 times, because after refusing the 2nd time, this terrible spirit appears, and then the person gets too frightened to hold back the 3rd time. Okay, so the spirit appears with the thunderbolt, thinking, if Satchika doesn't answer the Buddha after he's asked the 3rd time, then I'm going to split his head into 7 pieces. And so both the Buddha and Satchika see the spirit up in the air, and then Satchika gets frightened. And now he says to the Buddha, ask me what you want, Master, I'm going to answer. Okay, so then the Buddha just repeats his question. He says, when you say that material form is myself, do you exercise any such power over material form so that you can say, let my form be thus, let my form not be thus? Okay, and then Satchika says, no, Master Gotama. And so now, from this exchange, we can see one essential component of the idea of self. This is the way the idea of self came to be conceived in Indian spirituality, and it's probably what underlies the idea of self even in our own way of thinking, even though we're not from India, or we're not steeped in Indian spirituality. But this seems to be a basic component of the idea of self. This basic component is the idea that if anything is truly a self, truly mine, then I should be able to exercise power over that thing in such a way that I could bend it completely to my will. And this is expressed in this passage in two ways. I should be able to say, let so-and-so be thus, let it be the way I want it to be, and let my such-and-such not be thus. May it never act in any way that is contrary to my desire. And so if form, the body, is truly myself, then I should be able to control bodily form such that if I want to be beautiful, I can be beautiful. If I want to become young again, 25 years old, I just have to make the decision and I'm 25 years old again. If I'm ill and I want to be healthy, I just have to make the decision, let me be healthy and I'll be healthy. So the idea of self, this is, in Indian terms, this is the atta or atman. The idea of a truly existing self implies the power to dominate and to control, the power to exercise perfect mastery, perfect control over all the components of that self. And then the other side, let my form not be thus. Let me not grow old. I just have to make that decision. Let me not grow old, and I don't grow old. Let me not fall sick. I don't fall sick. Let me not die, and I don't die. So I have this perfect mastery over bodily form. And so when the Buddha says, do you have that power over form, the bodily form, so you could say, let my body be thus, let my body not be thus, Satchika has to admit, no, I don't have that power. And when he makes that admission, he knows in his own mind, and of course the Buddha knows, that effectively he's admitting defeat, that he's lost the argument. Okay, maybe I should pause at this point, then ask whether there's any questions. Yes, please.
I just assume that that is reinforced where he's addressing the Buddha as Master Gotama.
No. When he uses this, it's a little bit misleading, the rendering master. I think maybe not so good. And it doesn't mean that he is looking to the Buddha as his own master.
Okay, it's not a statement of conversion.
No, no. The word that's, maybe it's not so satisfactory, the translation master, because in English, this implies that one is looking at the other person as one's own master. But in Pali, this is Bo Gotama. Bo is just like a polite address. We might even say like honorable Gotama or something like good man, good Gotama, or if it weren't somewhat secular, even like a little bit like Mr. Gotama, except that Mr. in English, you wouldn't use that to address a religious person. Maybe it would be something like Reverend or Venerable Gotama, which all of the wanderers, when they would meet the wanderers of the other religion, they would address their opponent as Bo so-and-so, Master so-and-so. It doesn't imply that they look to that person as their spiritual teacher or master. I think that your question gave me a good reason for stopping this translation of Bo as master, because it's a little bit misleading in that respect. Suki. Okay, the question is Atta and Atman the same? They're exactly the same. The word is exactly the same. It's just that Atta is the Pali form, then Atma is the Sanskrit form.
The idea of Atman in India.
Yeah. Okay, whether Atman is a source or completeness.
Okay.
Or does Atman imply power? Yeah, okay. The way we know the word Atman, you know, from the Sanskrit is generally from the Upanishads, which were spiritual texts based on the Vedas. They would have initially been composed, the oldest ones, before maybe one or even two centuries before the Buddha, perhaps starting the 7th century, 6th century BC. And the central idea of the Upanishads, or at least the major Upanishads, is that there is some imperishable reality within the human being, within all human beings, which is called the Atman. That was the great inquiry within the Upanishads, is what is the real self of the person, of a living being? And so the sages of the Upanishads investigated this question from many angles, and then they came to the conclusion that the body perishes, so whatever perishes cannot be the real Atman. The real Atman has to be something eternal, imperishable, everlasting. And so it can't be the body, it can't be the feelings, it can't be the mind, it can't be the vital activities. And so eventually they arrived at the idea that within the person there is some imperishable reality beyond all of the bodily and mental acquisitions. They call them the sheaths or envelopes that enclose the Atman. And this Atman, the innermost self of the person, is at the same time the underlying reality of the whole universe. At least this is a theme that we meet in some of the Upanishads. So behind all the phenomena of the earth, the heavens, the skies, the world systems, there is a changeless, unchanging reality. And that changeless reality is nothing other than our own innermost self. So that changeless external reality, that is called Brahman, the divine power of the universe. And that divine power is the Atman, the innermost self. Okay, so this is a highly refined conception of the Atman. But along with that conception, even in the Upanishads, is the idea that the Atman is the inner controller of everything that takes place. So whatever takes place in the universe is happening through the control of the Atman, this universal, imperishable self. Okay, now the way the Buddha uses the word Atta in his discourses, it doesn't seem to be especially tied to the Upanishadic conception of Atman. But it seems to be, most of the time he's using Atta the way we ordinarily think of ourselves. Well, let us say the way we think of ourselves when we're trying to be somewhat philosophical. We're trying to find our true identity, what we really are. And if we reflect a little bit about this question, then we feel that we have to give some kind of content to our notion of self. So when we try to fill in the idea of self, we might think, I am the body, or I am feelings, or the Buddha uses these five categories as the basic ways in which people conceive the self. I'm the body, I'm feelings, I'm perceptions, I am mental formations, these will be acts of volition, or I am consciousness. And so the Buddha says, whoever conceives of a self in any way conceives of these five aggregates as a self, or one among them. Okay, and then, so this is the way all reflective ideas, all philosophical ideas of a self are conceived of in terms of the five aggregates. Even though this thinker might come from Europe, he doesn't use the term five aggregates, he doesn't have the same names, but whatever one finds to be the self, it will turn out to be one or another of the five aggregates. For example, René Descartes, I don't think he ever heard of the Buddha, never read any Buddha suttas, so he thought, there must be some, I can doubt everything, everything that I see, everything I feel, all of this could just be an hallucination, an illusion conjured up by some mischievous demon. But when I turn within myself and examine myself, I find that I'm thinking. And so therefore that thinking is myself. I think, therefore I am. Cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. So my thinking, that is myself. So he could say his thinking, probably put that someplace in the mental formations aggregate, or maybe the aggregate of consciousness. It was only David Hume, Scottish philosopher, who came very close to the teaching of anatta. He said that when I look within myself, all I find are ever-changing perceptions, thoughts, feelings, and I never find anything within which is stable and lasting that I could identify as myself. Okay, so what the Buddha has done through his enlightenment is that he has realized or seen that all of these factors that we ordinarily take to be myself, when looked at with wisdom or with insight, are not self, anatta, empty of self. And so when one gains that insight, then by seeing the five aggregates as not self, then one releases them, lets go. And by letting go, there comes liberation. We will deal with that next week. Okay, any further questions? Okay, Pat. Is this the point where he should sort of yield to the Buddha? No, not yet. The argument still has to develop further. The Buddha is actually going to, you could say, at this point he's lost. He knows he's lost. The Buddha, of course, knows he's lost because the Buddha deliberately contrived this. But the Buddha hasn't yet pulled the strings together. He hasn't yet drawn out the consequences and laid them out very clearly and explicitly to Satchika so that he sees that he's defeated. Even though, you know, it's still at the tacit level, the implicit level. They both know that Satchika's lost, but it's not yet been brought out into the open. And maybe the Lichavis who are sitting there witnessing it, maybe they don't yet realize what's taken place. And actually, even though it's a general principle in Indian spirituality that the one who's defeated yields and joins the other party, this doesn't happen with Satchika. He never embraces the Buddha as his teaching, as his teacher. But I'll get to that next week. Okay, we'll have to stop now. And so we end with the sharing of the merits. So we share the merits with the devas, the nagas, or dragon spirits, the buddhas, the fear spirits, and all other beings, wishing them to be well and happy. Akasata chabumata Devanaga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Sasanang Akasata Chabumata Devanaga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Desanang Akasata Chabumata Deva Naga Mahitika Punyantang Anumoditva Chirang Rakantu Mang Parang Eta Vatacha Hehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabbe Deva Anumodantu Sabba Sampati Siddhya Eta Vatacha Hehi Sampadang punya sampadang Sabbe bhutanumodantu Sabba sampati siddhya Eta vatacha hehi Sampadang punya sampadang Sabbe sata anumodantu Sabba sampati siddhya.